A lot of people, including me, are starting to wonder how, when, and if this pandemic is ever going to end. Well, pandemics do end in different ways. This one probably won't end the way smallpox did, with eradication, at least not for a while, because the virus is evolving too fast and our vaccines don't completely block transmission. But there are other viruses that have settled into a less deadly pattern. The 1918 flu became a seasonal flu, and AIDS became a manageable disease after people developed effective antiviral drugs. And despite the enormous surge right now, a lot of experts are actually pretty optimistic that the current pandemic is going to wind down thanks to pretty effective vaccines and the emergence of some really effective antiviral drugs. That's the topic of today's episode of Follow the Science, an exploration of science, medicine, and medical misinformation. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist, and this podcast grew out of a fellowship from the Society for Professional Journalists. My guest today is Derek Lowe. He's a medicinal chemist, and he knows more than anyone I've talked to about drugs, about how they work, how they're discovered, how they're tested, and how they're mass-produced. He writes a blog for Science magazine called In the Pipeline, which is all about the business and science of pharma. And he's been on this podcast before talking about ivermectin, why it's unlikely to work, and about concerns that vaccines could backfire and how these were laid to rest. Now we're talking on a more upbeat note about some drugs that look very promising, including one called Paxlovid, which showed 89% efficacy in a clinical trial. So despite horrible COVID numbers now, there's a lot of optimism out there that while we can't eradicate this virus, we do have the technology to end the death, suffering, and disruption. I'm really glad we had a chance to connect because people are really curious about a few drugs, especially Paxlovid. People have been calling it a game changer. I don't know. What do you think? How promising is it?
I think it's very promising, but the problem is going to be supply for a little bit. If we suddenly had 1 billion doses of it ready to roll, it would change the game very quickly, but that is not what we have.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty good drug if the biggest problem with it is that we just don't have enough.
Yeah, that's true. That's not exactly a major strike against something, is it? Now, there is another bit longer term worry in that any sort of antiviral drug, just like an antibiotic, for the same reasons can bring on resistance in the organism. So it is possible that as time goes on, we might see strains of the coronavirus that manage to get around the effect of Paxlovid, but that's not what we're seeing so far.
Interesting. Yeah. So I wondered if we could go over how it works. So from what I understand, it's two drugs. One is a protease inhibitor and the other actually prevents your liver from metabolizing it as fast so that you get a better effect from it.
Exactly. And that second drug, ritonavir, is an old HIV medication, and it does nothing per se to the coronavirus. All it's in there for is to make the dose of the real drug better in the body because of that metabolism. And in fact, ritonavir is used in HIV drug cocktails for the same reason. It's really not doing all that much against the HIV virus, but it's there to make the doses of the others larger because otherwise they would just be shredded by the liver pretty quickly.
Not only does this drug have a component that's also in HIV drug cocktails, but it also has a component called a protease inhibitor that works exactly like HIV drugs. It stops viruses from making a protein that it needs to replicate itself. And so the protease inhibitor goes after a protein that the virus needs to replicate, or it goes after its ability to cut this protein. It's a protease, so it stops an enzyme from working?
Exactly. And it is a protease that's called the main protease. So you can see already that it's really hitting at something major. These viruses they're really kind of amazing in an eerie sort of way, because the main protease is a protein that's already being coded for in the viral genome. It's one of the first things that gets made, and its job is to start unpacking everything else. it starts chopping its own sequence up. It starts chopping other viral proteins and starts assembling the proteins that the virus needs, because it doesn't have all of those just ready to go. The main protease has to reach in there and start breaking pieces apart. It's a little bit like unpacking something, you know, that you get by mail order. You've got this, okay, remove this from the packaging. Now separate these two things so that you can see the such and such. If you could imagine a package being delivered and this little robot arm reaching out of the package and starting to do all that, that's kind of what a virus is doing to itself.
Wow. And so it sort of has to, when it goes into a new cell, it goes into a form that it's not ready to replicate itself right away. It has to go through this step.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has to, it goes in and it starts hijacking the cell's protein making machinery. And that starts cranking out viral proteins. But before it can even do that, the main protease has to assemble things. So the main protease is what really makes the virus a virus. Without it, nothing can get going. It's just a bunch of proteins that aren't ready to do anything.
Interesting. And so, I mean, it's interesting to me that this is such a promising drug and that the first drugs that really worked well against HIV were protease inhibitors, weren't they?
Yep. Yep. It's no coincidence because a lot of viruses work by a mechanism like this. They have some key protease that's part of their packaging and part of their, okay, now it's time to assemble a real virus to go out and replicate some more. They do that because viruses are actually, as far as I'm concerned, they're not alive. They're just bits of code. The analogy to a computer virus is actually pretty tight. And they don't have an awful lot of room for a huge number of genetic instructions. So everything is compressed and packed in there as tightly as possible, both physically and kind of conceptually or algorithmically. So having a protease coded for first that then goes around and assembles the other stuff actually saves room.
That's fascinating. And I think we talked about that a little bit in our previous conversation about how the virus works, but there were no protease inhibitors at the time. What about side effects? I know people who take HIV drugs long-term can have some pretty bad side effects, or at least in the early days they did. I think maybe those cocktails have been reformulated. Is this going to be different because it's such a short-term thing? You just take it for a few days?
Exactly. Because if you're with HIV, we don't have a regimen that can totally knock it down. What we have are our drug cocktails, which are terrific because they keep people alive, but they fight the virus to a standstill. But in this case, you will take this and then the combination of knocking the virus down with this protease inhibitor and your body's own immune system will clear the virus. That's the problem with HIV. Notoriously, the immune system does not clear it.
So what about the logistical issues that apparently you have to get it fairly early in your infection? Do you think that there are ways that the medical community can equip high-risk people with home tests so that they can be aware that they need it? It seems like that's the hard part, is how do you know you need this drug if you're giving it before you actually get sick enough to be hospitalized?
Yeah. Well, the good thing that you're right, though, that has been a problem with some antivirals. For example, there are a few medications out there for flu, and their big problem has been that by the time you know you should take the drug, it's almost too late to take the drug. But this one seems to be a little bit more, have a little bit more slack in it, because Pfizer's clinical trial looked at people who took it within 3 days of showing symptoms. And a separate group took it within 5 days of showing symptoms, and the results were almost the same. The within 3 days group was a little bit better, but the within 5 days group still had a very strong response. So that gives you a little bit of leeway there. You don't have to immediately rush and start taking this when you think you have something. You can find out, okay, I really do have symptoms. And yeah, you're right. You would probably want to back that up with some kind of rapid test. And there's you definitely have the coronavirus. By that point, though, you are still within the window where you can take the drug.
Right. So then the question is, with the short supply, it seems like we wouldn't want to give it to people who were likely to recover easily on their own. We'd want to give it to people who had a reasonably large chance of dying. So how do we decide which people should be on the lookout for an early infection and ready to get a prescription for this?
These are the same people who should already be on the lookout, though, because they're already the ones at risk of having a much more severe infection. Basically, if you're the older you are, the more you should look out. If you have any sort of immune compromised state by medication or by some, you know, genetic issue, and if you have pre-existing conditions that we know make coronavirus infection worse, those are particular, I guess, high weight, very high overweight, diabetes, or respiratory conditions already. If you're already in those categories, you should be looking out anyway. And you are exactly the sort of person who should be ready to take this drug if you do come down with the virus.
And that also leads to a question I think we're going to see a lot of controversy surrounding this, because we know that people who willfully turn down the vaccines are at much higher risk than the rest of us. And yet, you know, people are angry at those people. So do you see any way we're going to deal with this without a big fight?
I am really curious to see what kind of fight develops, because to be honest, the people who are fighting taking the vaccine at this point are just ready to fight. And they may look at this drug and say, huh, Pfizer, this is made by the same company that made the vaccine I'm not taking. I'm not taking this either. That would be a severe mistake, but not getting the vaccine is a severe mistake too.
Yes. Yeah. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out, because the unvaccinated do seem to be at much higher risk, even with Omicron, despite all the immune escape. It seems like our vaccines, and especially the boosters, offer quite a bit of protection. So I wonder if, you know, some of the people who have some of these conditions, obesity and type 2 diabetes, also are sort of disconnected from our healthcare system in a way that they're not in touch with a doctor.
Yeah, this is not a good time to be disconnected from it, I'll tell you. I don't know how it's going to play out. I mean, this really could help out so much in keeping people out of the hospital. And as you mentioned, if you look at kind of the sliding scale, people who have had the full vaccinations, including the boosters, are much less risk of getting sick. And when they get sick, they have far, far less chance of getting anything severe. People who've had just the two vaccinations and no booster definitely can get Omicron. That's happening a lot, but they still have a much lower chance of getting Omicron and ending up in the hospital. The people in the hospital, yeah, they are overwhelmingly people who are not vaccinated at all. And if they are vaccinated, you find that they have other risk factors like immunocompromised condition or something like that. So you're right. It's these last people who really could be saved from going into the hospital at all if they can take this drug. That would be so much better for them, and it would be so much better for our entire healthcare system.
I then ask him about side effects and potential downsides of this drug. Well, it's much better to get vaccinated and not get COVID in the first place. But if that fails, this drug does look pretty safe.
The good thing about this antiviral drug is it is attacking this main protease of the coronavirus, and that protease is different than the proteases that we have in our own body. And that's been seen in the clinical trials. They really have not seen any safety signals off of this one. That's the good part of working on antibiotics and antivirals, is that these organisms are mostly different enough from us that if you target their enzymes, you have a much lower chance of hitting one of our own enzymes. So I would say that this one actually looks pretty clean from the data we have so far. And if I were unvaccinated, believe me, I'm vaccinated all the way up to my earlobe.
Yeah, yes, you have the booster, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Oh yeah, don't believe me. I went out and got it as fast as I possibly could. But if I were unvaccinated and at risk, I would jump at the chance to take this drug, because the clinical data are very clear. It seems to do a very good job of keeping people exactly like that out of the hospital and off of a respirator.
are a couple of other promising drugs out there. There's one called fluvoxamine. It's an antidepressant, so it's already in use and looks like it would be pretty cheap and safe. And there's a drug by Merck, and both of those have shown efficacy that's reasonable, but not nearly as high as the Pfizer drug Paxlovid. And that's going to leave us with a pretty big ethical conundrum in the weeks and probably months before we get the supply of this drug ramped up. There could be a lot of people who end up needing this drug. There are going to be people who are immunocompromised, who've gotten fully vaccinated and even boosted, but have conditions that make the vaccine less effective. And there are also going to be a lot of people that just haven't gotten the vaccine for various reasons, even though they should have. And doctors are going to have to decide who gets priority when there's limited supply. I mean, that gets to the sort of policy implications of all this, because it seems like we have different categories of people. We have the willfully unvaccinated, and then we have the immunocompromised, who most of whom have gotten the vaccine, but are still pretty worried because they're the ones who are going to be at risk even if they do the right thing.
Oh, yeah. I know people in that situation. I really feel for them because, right, they're just sitting there and they're like, okay, I've done everything I can do, but that may not be enough.
Yeah. And so do you think that the Paxlovid, if we can get that ramped up in a couple of months, that that's really going to change the situation for those people?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That will be something that's a rescue net for them, that if they do get infected, then they'd be quite worried because they know that they're at higher risk of progressing on to a more severe infection. But this, of course, Paxlovid has nothing to do with the immune system per se. It's just going right for the gears and the workings inside the virus. So it will work the same on them as it works for someone who's not immune compromised.
Interesting. Well, I guess that's protease inhibitors work for HIV, and people with HIV are by nature immune compromised. So it seems like that is really going to change things. Is there any way to predict what the time scale is for when this drug could be abundant enough that all of those people would be able to get it if they got infected?
I'm a small molecule guy by nature. That's what I do for a living, is work on small molecule drugs. I'm an organic chemist, and we know a lot of ways to make these things. And the process plant people and the chemical engineers know a lot of ways to make them on huge scale. So it's not that making Paxlovid requires any sort of esoteric thing like the mRNA manufacturer does. It's getting the starting materials to make it. That's the problem. And that's where the crunch is.
Oh, that some of the materials that go into the process might be in short supply.
Yes, and we have all been hearing about supply chain problems.
Yes.
The last few weeks and months. Those apply to fine chemical manufacture and how. Because if you look at the Paxlovid synthesis, it's a number of steps, which is pretty typical for a reasonably complicated drug like this one. Each of those steps requires different reagents and sometimes different starting materials coming into the synthesis. And each of those things has to be sourced. So if you're Pfizer, you're like, okay, we need a whole bunch of this reagent. Like there's one called Dibok, Bok anhydride. And I'm not going to talk about the chemistry of it, of course, but that's a common laboratory reagent. I've used it many, many times. I've never thought about where Dibok comes from. Well, it comes from a supplier almost certainly in China. In fact, there may be only a few suppliers, and all the other catalogs you order it from buy it from the same people and sell it to each other before they sell it to you. So how much Dibok is there? How many people make it? How much of it can they make real fast and make it in sufficient purity and get it delivered, et cetera, et cetera? That happens over and over. You've got 5, 10, a dozen, 20 different chemicals you have to worry about in the same way.
Wow, that does sound like we need a sort of wartime-like effort to ramp up the everything involved in putting this together.
Yeah, up to a point. But here's the tricky part. We don't have the chemical plants here in the U.S. to make many of these things. We did 50 years ago, but we don't now.
So we'll really depend on China and other countries that have this.
Right, we're depending on other countries that do still have a big, ugly, dirty, smelly fine chemical industry. A lot of these supply chains trace back offshore. The great majority of them do. And if you say, okay, we're going to use like the Defense Production Act and we're going to make Dybok, you have just said, we're going to build an entire factory to make Dybok somewhere and get that cranked up. And that also means that you need to find out, okay, where does Dybok come from? What materials do I need to make that? And so on and so on. You're talking about recreating something that has been disappearing for a long time.
We go on to talk about the public health failures that have led to so few people getting booster shots, even among those who are clearly at higher risk because of their age or health conditions. I wonder if there are also policy mistakes that have led to such a low rate of booster uptake. I was talking to a doctor last night and asking him, well, who's in the ICU right now? And he said, well, people who actually have high-risk conditions but haven't gotten a booster.
I wonder about that, too, because I remember I mentioned on the blog that I'd gotten a booster. And, you know, the people who read my blog are at least fairly informed or feel like being informed. And someone popped up in the comments saying, wow, you're the first person I've ever seen that's talking about how everyone should go get a booster. Man, that's something. And that just bowled me over because I was like, oh, my God, how do people not know this? But apparently a lot of them don't.
It's funny that the Moderna and Pfizer that Pfizer doesn't seem to be looking quite as good, though I had three Pfizer, so I'm hoping that doesn't turn out to be the case. But they're so similar that it's sort of surprising that they would diverge, since they're sort of the same product, aren't they?
Welcome to immunology. That's all I can say about that. We are constantly brought up short by the complexities of the human immune system. We can't predict these things, and the only way we find out is by empirical data from humans who've taken it. That's really not a comforting thing to say, but if we could actually predict these things, we wouldn't have these situations. But human immunology is one of the most complicated things that you could ever stick your head into.
Yes. Actually, I've been asking people because I'm looking for some new immunologists to interview. And it's complex, but it's also, I think, inherently interesting just because it's almost one of the most interesting facets of the human body that we can do this.
Oh, it is. It is. And it's the most personal, unique thing about any of us. When they start doing, you know, DNA analysis for forensics, they go and they look at the most variable pieces of it, which often have to do with the immune system. It's something to see. It's almost impossible to get your head around how many different antibodies each of us are carrying. And even though we might have this unimaginable number of different ones, we're still totally different from every other human on the planet. Our brains just can't get around these ideas.
Yeah. So I actually, a radio host asked me this question. He said, do you think that if COVID mutates into, you know, some as yet worse form, that the human race will go extinct? And I said, no, just because we are so diverse in our immunity that there will be some people out there who will survive.
Absolutely. We have gotten through all these other plagues. We got through the plague of Justinian, whatever it was. We got through the Black Death. We've gotten through all of these other things. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't have a worse infectious agent that would be absolutely awful. But no, the whole point of everyone having their own immune fingerprint is that it's very hard to get rid of us that way. The species that could be gotten rid of by one pathogen are all gone. Our ancestors were the other guys.
I guess that's probably right. True of every animal that has gotten to survive to the present day, except maybe a few that have been depleted down to, you know, a tiny number of related individuals.
The author Neal Stephenson, one of his books starts out where he calls his main character a stupendous badass. And he said he's that just because he's alive. Just like every other living creature on Earth, he is a stupendous badass because he is still here, he and his species.
Yeah, yeah. So it is an intriguing question, and it does get at this, the fact that our immune systems are all different, even within a family,
right,
that they're different.
Right. I mean, we've had some influenza going around, and Some of us in the extended family have gotten it, and some of them haven't. Everyone has these things happen. And you see allergies. Some people have a shellfish allergy and their sister doesn't. We're all different that way. The immune system is partly what we're born with and also based on built-up experience with antigens, and we're each living our own lives and exposed to different things.
Do you think that explains in part why these waves go up to a point and then they don't, you know, they're going up exponentially and they're still far from reaching all the susceptible people or all the people we think are susceptible, and then they make a U-turn and go back down? We saw it here last winter. We saw it just happen with Omicron in South Africa.
Yeah, that has to be part of it. You're infecting the people who are most easily infected, at least some of them. And then, of course, there's human behavior, too, because other people will see these lines going straight up. I mean, the joke was that we finally flattened the curve, except we flattened it against the y-axis instead. But they'll see these lines going straight up, and people will modify their behavior, too, at least the more reasonable ones. And that also starts to send it back down.
Yeah, though it seemed like what happened in South Africa, it turned around before people thought it would, and I don't know how much people change their behavior. So it does seem like there's something else going on, especially since it makes such a dramatic U-turn.
There is. And in fact, that's one reason that people have been hedging their bets on the South African experience as applied to other countries. Because, for example, there may be an immunologic background that some other countries don't share.
Yes.
Among them, the fact that there was more beta variant coronavirus earlier on in South Africa. It's not impossible that exposure to beta could change how you deal with Omicron. However, I don't think that explanation is holding up, and I'm really going to be happy if it doesn't.
Yeah, me too. Somebody I interviewed this morning said the exact same thing. Like, they had their immunologically different from us because they had a lot of beta. We didn't really have beta or had very little. And so if that is what makes them different, then we better be worried.
Exactly. So far, I don't quite think that's happening, but it's not something you can completely rule out. And again, that's immunology. We can't theorize our way to the right answer on these things. You just have to say, well, let's see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know I've asked you a lot of questions. Is there anything else that maybe even something I might want to do a future podcast on?
Let me think. That's a good question. I'm trying to get my head around more of the logistics and supply chain stuff, but for Paxlovid, it's very difficult, though, because this stuff is kind of an art form. And I've worked at companies where I've seen the supply chain for a given drug. And it's always like, really? Whoa, that's strange, because there are a lot of prescription drugs that go through 2, 3, 4, 5 countries before they actually reach the final packaged, ready to sell state. And it's difficult unless you are making that your livelihood. It's very difficult to tell how that's going to break. I wish I had more to say about that because it's a fascinating subject. But those who say often don't know, because those who know often aren't saying.
Wow. So there will be a certain amount of suspense as we wait to see whether we can get the production up to what we need, and also maybe get the medical ethicists or other people to think about who should really be getting this drug.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems clear to me that it should be, as we have limited supplies, that it should go first to people who are at the greatest risk of clogging up a hospital bed in the ICU.
Yeah, yeah, because that will affect a whole bunch of other people.
Absolutely. That has so many downstream effects that it just seems incredibly obvious. But there's a lot of stuff that seemed incredibly obvious that apparently wasn't.
Derek Lowe's blog, In the Pipeline, in Science Magazine, is mostly about drugs, about drug science and drug business, but sometimes it's also about cooking and the chemistry of cooking, and there are occasionally some really quite interesting recipes. Well, your blog is great, and I'm going to try that recipe for the cranberry pie. That looks...
Yeah, we made some. In fact, I think we got we need to polish that thing off. It's down in a kind of a cold room downstairs. I need to break that out.
It looks like, I love the way you combine cooking with chemistry in your blog. And, you know,
yeah, there's another recipe up today. Actually, I put an Iranian rice recipe up after consulting with my wife for an extended period.
Oh, great. I'll take a look at that. That sounds also good. And the part about the color of the pie was really interesting.
You'll notice it when the lime juice goes in. So yeah, what you get is something that's a lot like, in the sourness and consistency, a lot like a key lime pie, but with an extra cranberry note.
Wow. And then it comes this beautiful pink color that is completely different from the color of the cranberries.
Yeah, it doesn't even look like something you should be putting in your mouth.
Yes, it looks like something that has a carcinogenic dye in it.
Right, right, exactly. But it's all natural cranberries.
Well, I'm glad we could end on kind of a fun note during these dark days. My local store is out of fresh cranberries, but when they come back, I am definitely making that pie. And in the meantime, I'm glad I had a chance to talk for a second week about Paxlovid, because I think its introduction could affect us all. And it would make sense if this pandemic winds down because of a combination of an effective drug and vaccines that aren't perfect but work really pretty well against hospitalization and death. And so I think for society, living with COVID doesn't have to mean living with so much death and suffering. It could mean living with a virus that's mild in most people and treatable in the rest.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam. You can follow Faye on Twitter at Faye Flam. That is FAYEFLAM. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman, with music by Kyle Imperator. If you liked today's episode, we'd really love it if you left us a positive rating and review wherever you listened. Thanks in advance, and we'll see you next week.